I'm Marco Werman, and I want to take a moment to say thank you. Thank you to everyone who has stepped up to support this show in the last few weeks. And if you have not yet, don't worry, you can still right now. Just head to theworld.org/match and make a gift of any amount today. That's theworld.org/match. And thanks.
This was the scene at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad on this New Year's Eve. Iraqi militia chanted anti-American slogans after breaching the compound's walls. I'm Carol Hills. How we got to this point ahead this hour? Plus, 2019 was a year of internet shutdowns, and governments are getting precise with their targets.
You might get a shutdown because of who you are and not where you are.
The 2010s were a decade of progress for many LGBTQ communities, but people who are intersex are still often told to keep quiet.
I do understand why they say that, because there was a belief actually one time that we are the ones that stops the rain from coming, and so we are bad luck.
Tatenda Nwaru from Zimbabwe. Her story and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's New Year's Eve, and the U.S. is sending several dozen Marines to Baghdad. According to Defense Secretary Mark Esper, their mission is to boost security at the U.S. embassy, which is under a blockade. Earlier today, members of an Iraqi militia broke into the embassy compound, shouting anti-American slogans. The mob was mostly unarmed. They're protesting a deadly U.S. airstrike on Sunday, which targeted their militia group. The area around the U.S. embassy is heavily fortified, but Iraqi government forces there largely stood aside, although they did fire stun grenades to protect the embassy itself. The protesters smashed down a door and set fires. The State Department says the embassy itself was not breached and has not been evacuated. Washington is blaming Iran for the protest. Wait, Iran? But we're talking about Iraq. It's all really confusing. So to help explain, I'm joined by The World's Chris Wolf. Chris, who are these protesters?
Well, Carol, pictures show and witnesses say that these are mostly men who belong to a pro-Iranian militia group called Kataib Hezbollah. Most are not carrying weapons, but many are wearing those uniforms of that organization and carrying their flags. This is the same group, Carol, that was bombed by the U.S. Air Force on Sunday, and the same group that allegedly attacked the U.S. base near Kirkuk on Friday, killing a U.S. contractor. So just to recap, events-wise, we had Friday, the attack on the U.S. base, which killed an American. Sunday, the U.S. retaliates with their airstrikes. And then today, we have the assault on the embassy compound.
So going back to that Friday attack at the U.S. base, why would this Iraqi militia group that is loyal to Iran attack a U.S. base?
We don't know for sure, but there have been dozens of similar attacks over the past few months against U.S. targets in Iraq. None as big as this, which involved 30 rockets. Now, the U.S. government says the attacks are being directed by Iran, Iraq's big neighbor to the east. Iran's going broke under the pressure of the global U.S. embargo on oil sales, Trump's maximum pressure campaign. And it's been trying to find ways to put pressure back on the U.S. to relax those sanctions. And one of the ways it's using is to have its friends around the Middle East region go after U.S. targets.
Oh, so a real proxy thing. Iran using a militia group in Iraq to go after U.S. interests there to, in some roundabout way, pressure the U.S. to lift sanctions or to deal with Iran.
Right, yes. So it's an indirect pressure campaign.
Okay, another question is, why are there even any armed militias roaming around freely in Iraq at this point?
Yeah, let alone ones controlled by a foreign country like Iran. Well, you have to go back to 2014. That's when ISIS, the Islamic State movement, annihilated one-third of the Iraqi army in a single battle. So the Baghdad government appealed to the masses of Iraqis to help defend the capital, and hundreds of thousands of people formed these ad hoc militias. And they did play a critical role in the fight against ISIS. But these are not just like well-armed neighborhood watches. Many were formed by political groups. Many were sponsored, armed, and trained by Iran. So this was tolerated by the U.S. and Baghdad because of the emergency need to fight ISIS, but they were never demobilized or disarmed.
So the events this week, they show a real anger at the U.S., by Iraqis. What's at the root of that?
Well, let's be clear. There is no single Iraqi point of view. Rather, Iraq is a complex mosaic of regional, ethnic, religious and political interests. So it's difficult to generalize. But historically, many dislike the fact of U.S. conquest and occupation from 2003. But the specific complaint today is that the U.S. is attacking and bombing this pro-Iranian militia. This is the first time that the U.S. has taken this direct kind of military action in Iraq against any target other than ISIS for almost a decade. And many Iraqis see it as an affront to the country's sovereignty and their pride. But we must remember that Iraqis are also plenty mad at Iranian influence, too. There have been massive, bloody demonstrations in Baghdad throughout most of this year against corruption and Iranian influence. And those have been much bigger than the demonstration today at the U.S. Embassy.
The World's Chris Wolf, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Carol.
It's already 2020 in Hong Kong. Residents welcomed in the new year with celebrations and with pro-democracy protests. The city canceled its main event, a fireworks display, citing security concerns. As the clock neared midnight, demonstrators formed human chains at major landmarks around the city. They chanted their agenda.
In the new year, we'll also fight for democracy and freedom, and we must let the government to accept our demands so Hong Kong will be a better place in the future.
These young activists have grown accustomed to spending most weekends out on the streets.
My friends and I always joke about it because this whole past year just seems like a major blur.
That's Hong Kong-based author and activist Karen Chung taking stock of how the past year has transformed the city she calls home.
I think if I look back on 2019, I remember all the dates, like 721 in Cantonese, that's Chet Yiyat. And that was the night when some thugs in Yuen Long beat up normal civilians. And that was a very shocking incident for a lot of us because it felt like the city had descended into really lawlessness. And then I remember the big protests as well, like June 9, June 12, June 16. But I also remember kind of the life that happens in between. There are times when it's quite peaceful and you could be walking down the streets and you think, oh, like maybe it's almost as if nothing much has changed. But then if you take a look around more carefully, you realize it has. I remember just taking the tram one night and it passes through all the major protest spots and the government buildings and the courts and everything. And I remember just looking at all the graffiti that they were trying to scrub and doing a really, really bad job of it. They just like basically smeared a little bit of white over it, but you can actually still make out the characters. Myself and a lot of my friends, you know, it used to be that when we walk on the streets, you know, Hong Kong is a very, very safe city. Like, I've never had to fear for really anything, even when I'm walking home alone at like 3 a.m. after like having gone out with some friends or whatever. But now it isn't really criminals that you're worried about. It's that the police would maybe suddenly stop you and you don't know what they might do. And I guess in these like more subtle ways that it feels changed. But on a day when not a lot of protests have happened, I go down to Central and I still see bankers, you know, rushing after lunch to go back to their offices. That's why, you know, a lot of people always talk about Hong Kong as like having parallel universes. It's like if you're very immersed in it, the only thing you can see is the spots where someone has beaten your friend up or the train station where cops have charged in. But, you know, if you're very oblivious and detached, I guess you could walk around and you could just be like, oh, that's just graffiti and nothing else is feels different for you. I wrote on my Facebook, I think maybe 2 months ago, that I was really worried about this continuing because it is taking such a huge physical and mental toll on Hong Kongers and protesters. And I joked about it with a friend a couple of days ago because he was like, it's Christmas. And I was like, yeah, it's a tear gas Christmas. I do really worry about the mental health consequences of this when it's such an everyday reality for you and you fear for your friends and your family's safety. And I think that's the hardest thing to come across sometimes, like how deeply personal it is for every one of us here. But at the same time, I'm also really worried that it's going to end, because our past history has shown that when our protest movement have ended, nothing much happens afterwards, and the political situation always gets even worse. And so I basically fear for all kinds of outcome.
That was Hong Kong-based author and activist Karen Chung reflecting on a tumultuous year in her city. Those are Paris opera musicians on strike and performing outside. They played music from Sergei Prokofiev's ballet, Romeo and Juliet. Their concert on the steps of the Paris Opera House was also a show of support for striking French transportation workers who are opposing an overhaul to the country's pension system. The transit strike is causing some serious headaches tonight for New Year's Eve partygoers. It's tough to get around Paris right now. The strike is also bad news for Europeans grappling with this decision, plane or train. For years, the answer within Europe was definitely plane. It's fast and super cheap. But now concerns about the climate impact of air travel are pushing more people to hop on the train, specifically overnight trains. And as Anna Muckerman reports from Vienna, rail operators are paying attention.
Rachel Mann's sons are excited as an electric blue train screeches to a halt in front of them in Vienna's main train station. The family is waiting to board a night train to Düsseldorf, Germany.
We live in Budapest, and we originally are from the UK, so we're kind of traveling back for our Christmas holidays via train.
They're visiting friends, making stops along the way, and they're not alone.
A lot of our friends are not flying at all anymore because of environmental reasons, which is a bit of an influence, but also because we wanted the children to have the experience.
Across Europe, rail companies say the demand for sleeper trains has boomed over the past 2 years.
Last year, we saw an increase by 10% in the ridership in our night trains.
Bernhard Rieder is a spokesman for ÖBB, the Austrian national railway company that runs the Vienna-Düsseldorf route, the largest operator of night trains in Europe. He says when neighboring countries shuttered their night services, Austria saw an opportunity.
First, France, later Switzerland, and finally Germany stepped down from night trains in 2016. And that was the day when we decided to increase this network.
Cheap flights within Europe can cost less than 50 euros. But if you book an overnight train early enough, the price can be comparable, especially if you factor in saving the cost of overnight accommodation. But Rieder says many riders are looking for the experience, regardless of the price.
So we have three classes. We have sitting car, couchette, and sleeping car. And the highest comfort level, the sleeping cars, is always booked, even weeks in advance.
The boom has also hit Sweden, where a private operator runs a summertime night train from Malmo to Berlin, a 12-hour journey. Up until 2017, the route wasn't profitable, and they considered canceling it. Then came the flight-shaming movement, Flygskam.
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 Which is, from an environmental perspective, the shame you put on yourself or people for taking the plane instead of taking train.
Now, the Swedish railway operator expects to increase its number of night departures by 150%. And in the UK, another recent bet on night routes. The Caledonian Sleeper just put new cars on the tracks this year. It's the revival of a nighttime route between London and Scotland that's been in existence since 1863. Back at Platform 7 in Vienna, Rachel Mann says the night train has another advantage over the plane. Her kids can move around.
And they can play. They like to be able to play and get out of their seats.
But they'll be belted in on the last leg of their trip. They're flying to Britain. For that piece of the route, it's much cheaper than the train. For The World, Anna Muckerman, Vienna.
You're with The World.
I'm Marco Werman. If you're a regular listener to The World, then you've heard me make the case for supporting the work we do. We're here every day covering the global news that we think matters most to you. The current news cycle is fast and can be overwhelming. That's why at The World, we take the time to go deeper and bring you the human stories behind the biggest events of our time. Perspective matters, and if you value the perspective the world brings, then please act now. Join other listeners like you and make a donation at theworld.org/match. It doesn't matter how much you give, it just matters that you do. That's theworld.org/match, and thank you for your support.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Shutting down the internet and blocking access to social media. We saw governments across the world do this time and time again this year, especially during periods of political unrest. The World's Lydia Amanalidou takes a look at a record-breaking year for internet shutdowns and what we can expect in 2020.
In October 2015, Alp Toker, a computer engineer from London, was visiting Turkey. He was in the capital, Ankara, near the city's main train station.
There was a protest going on a few roads away. And there was a deadly terror attack. It was a so-called Islamic State, and over 100 people were killed.
The sound you're hearing there, it comes from local media, which captured the blasts and the chaotic aftermath on video. Toker remembers rushing to the scene of the attack.
We were trying to help victims, trying to just get people connected, in touch with their families. That's when it struck, when the internet disruption struck, and social media was cut.
Toker says people were frantically trying to contact their families to learn about what was happening, but they couldn't. The Turkish government eventually said that it cut off some internet access to protect the dignity of the victims, to prevent disinformation from spreading. But this, Toker says, made an already terrifying, traumatizing, and chaotic situation even worse.
And that just set my mission. You know, this can't happen. Governments can't do this. It's not helping anyone. And I think that I can help in some small way. So from that day, I never really stopped tracking shutdowns.
Tracking shutdowns is now Toker's full-time job. Shortly after leaving Turkey, he founded an organization called NetBlocks. Using a worldwide network of volunteers and sophisticated monitoring technology, Toker and his small team have been tracking internet outages all over the world. And this work that NetBlocks and other monitoring groups are doing is more relevant now than ever before because governments around the world are weaponizing social media blocks and total internet blackouts in unprecedented ways. This past year, in 2019, Toker and his team tracked hundreds of these incidents in dozens of countries.
We've seen shutdowns in Venezuela, Kazakhstan, Liberia, Iraq, West Papua, Egypt, Pakistan, Zimbabwe, Mauritania, Monrovia, Sri Lanka.
And many, many more. Of course, not every single internet outage was ordered by a government. And Toker says the reasons governments choose to shut down the internet are sometimes mundane. For example, earlier this year, Ethiopia turned off the internet for 4 days.
During school exams. Just to stop children from cheating, from copying answers.
But what Toker and other researchers are most concerned about are the types of politically driven shutdowns we've seen this year.
We've seen many more shutdowns during elections, so that is quite worrying.
Berhan Taye is a researcher based in Nairobi. She works for the organization Access Now, which tracked internet shutdowns in at least 35 countries this past year. In addition to shutdowns during elections, she says we're also seeing a rise in shutdowns during periods of political unrest. In Iraq, for example, the government turned off the internet during massive and deadly anti-government protests earlier this year. Officials say it was to keep violence to a minimum. Critics say it was to stop people from organizing and to keep news of turmoil contained in Iraq. Similar scenarios have played out in other countries, most recently in India. The government there shut down the internet in several parts of the country in response to deadly protests against a new citizenship law that critics say discriminates against Muslims.
The takeaway is that, you know, governments learn from each other. And they're not necessarily learning or copying the good things.
Researchers expect more and longer-lasting shutdowns in 2020. Alp Toker with NetBlocks says he also expects them to get more sophisticated and targeted.
We're starting to see even demographic targeting where you might get a shutdown because of who you are and not where you are. And it's the technology that's making this possible.
And he's also keeping a close eye on countries that are building their own national version of the internet. This is already the model in China. Iran and Russia have been making moves in that direction. And if they pull it off, Toker says, they'll have full control over the online narrative without even needing to pull the plug on the internet. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
The crystal ball in Times Square in New York is not the only thing dropping tonight. The World's Jessica Yarmosky has the story.
All right. The year is 1907. New York Times owner Adolph Ox has this great idea to mark the new year. He asks a young metal worker to build him a huge iron ball and lower it down a flagpole in the middle of New York City at midnight. He probably couldn't have fathomed that the Times Square ball drop would turn into such a beloved tradition, and also that other places might borrow that idea and give it a spin of their own. For example, at midnight tonight in St. George's, Bermuda, a large round object will drop from high up on the town hall. But it's not a ball.
You know, it's shaped like an onion. It has the whole, you know, green top part, and it's the color of an onion. And then it just has, like, white lights around it so that it highlights it.
Town manager Candy Lee Fogo is one of the folks in charge of this year's New Year celebration. In the mid-1800s, Bermudans began trading their distinctly sweet onions with the U.S. And ever since, Fogo says, the onion has served as their unofficial mascot. Which is why they've dropped a gigantic papier-mâché onion from the St. George's Town Hall every New Year's Eve since she can remember. She says this year is extra special.
When we got hit by Hurricane Umberto this past summer in October, it hit us. And the building that we had the onion stored in got damaged, like the roof got ripped off, but nothing miraculously happened to the onion. It was like, thank Lord.
Meanwhile, around 1,000 miles north, two towns in two countries come together to drop something of their own. Eastport, Maine, is just a stone's throw from New Brunswick in Canada. Lots of families there are transnational, and fishermen travel between both countries frequently. In 2005, Kristen McKinley, who founded the Tides Institute and Museum of Art in Eastport, wanted a way to celebrate the relationship between the two countries. Her first thought? A ball drop. Well, sort of.
So at 11 U.S. time, we celebrate the new year in Canada by dropping a plywood maple leaf sculpture from the third floor of our museum.
An hour later, when it's midnight in the eastern U.S., they pay tribute to Eastport's fishing history with another drop.
We drop a sardine sculpture, 8-foot sardine sculpture from that same third floor.
And after the fish hits the ground, people line up to kiss it. For good luck, of course. It's New Year's. For The World, I'm Jessica Yarmosky.
Here's another item that dropped this year, at least musically speaking. Jimena Sariñana's album, Donde Bailarán Las Niñas. The Mexican singer-songwriter made our top 10 of best albums of 2019. Sample the year's best tracks, chosen by The World's music team at theworld.org. The 2010s were a decade of worldwide protests.
Now across the square, it looks like there's a melee happening.
His cousin used his mobile phone to start filming the protests which developed.
Protests that are fueling political change. Global activism coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. On this New Year's Eve, we're saying goodbye to a decade, the awkwardly sounding 2010s. A lot has happened over the past 10 years, and for the LGBTQ community here in the U.S., a lot of good things. The legalization of same-sex marriage, the military ending discrimination against gay and lesbians, more LGBTQ members of Congress, and more openly gay athletes and celebrities.
Some countries around the world are using the United States as a model for how to expand legal protections. Other nations are not. They're moving in the opposite direction, passing laws to outlaw homosexuality and cracking down on activists. To take a look back at the decade of highs and lows for the LGBTQ community worldwide, my colleague Marco Werman spoke with Lucas Mendes. He's a senior research officer at ILGA World. That's the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association. He's also the author of the 2019 state-sponsored homophobia report, which tracks LGBTQ progress and discrimination around the world. Marco began the interview by asking, is the LGBT community closer to equality now than it was a decade ago?
Well, to give you a direct answer, yes. Under that headline, of course, then there's a lot of nuance. And we have to clarify who is we, because not all of us benefit from that progress equally.
In the past 10 years, if we just look at the U.S., there's been the legalization of same-sex marriage, changes in social attitudes, the government repealing a don't ask, don't tell, the military policy. Compare those gains to other countries. Where have you seen more progress toward LGBTQ equality?
It is true that most of the progress is in the West, I would say the Americas, Europe, and a few countries as well in Asia and in Southern Africa are making progress. In 2010, looking back 10 years back, only 7 countries actually recognized same-sex marriage at the national level. But now it's 28 countries, and we've seen that progress take place also with regard to protection against discrimination, especially in employment. For instance, looking back into the situation in 2010, 49 countries protected us against discrimination in employment, and now it's 77 countries.
Are there any countries you were surprised to see expand LGBTQ rights over the past decade?
Certainly. It used to be the case with Southern Africa that, South Africa was the leading country in the whole continent, but now we see other countries making progress as well. Mozambique and Botswana also protect people from discrimination in employment. So South Africa is no longer the lonely wolf in Africa.
Yet if you look at South Africa, a country with protections for LGBTQ rights, in reality, the violence still continues against the community. Why do you think that happens?
Legal reform and societal attitudes do not always go hand in hand. So sometimes you see one of the two factors changing before the other, or legal reform pushing a change in societal attitudes.
On the extreme end of the spectrum, countries that rank the lowest in terms of LGBTQ safety and rights are actually passing and enforcing laws that further restrict the rights of the LGBTQ community. Which countries are those, and what does life look like for LGBTQ people there?
Exactly. So there are still 6 countries in which the death penalty is effectively enforced, and those countries are Sudan, Somalia, a few provinces in Nigeria, Yemen, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. The situation on the ground is extremely difficult. And, you know, the people that were able to speak about the lived reality of LGBT people in those countries have actually fled the country before they were able to speak out. We wonder about the thousands and millions of people that are still living under those situations and cannot leave the country. It is very difficult for people on the ground to organize, let alone register an organization working on these issues. So the prospect of change in these 6 countries and in other countries that have similar laws is really dim.
I mean, you did speak earlier about the pendulum kind of swinging back to a darker time for LGBTQ rights. How concerned are you going into the next decade?
Well, actually, we have issued this report with mixed feelings, because we thought that criminalizing countries would never, you know, be added to the list. But we had to add Chad in 2017, and we had to add Gabon this year to that list. However, we are confident that the trend will still be decriminalization.
Lucas, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Marco, for having me.
That was my colleague Marco Werman speaking with Lucas Mendes, a senior research officer at ILGA World. That's the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans, and Intersex Association. That last word, intersex, is an umbrella term for people who are born with sexual anatomy that doesn't fit typical definitions of male or female. These can include genitals, hormone levels, and chromosome patterns. Intersex people might identify as a man, a woman, both, or neither. What they're often not, though, is included in the LGBTQ community. It's a fight Tetena Nwadu has faced since she was a child. Tetena is an intersex woman who was raised as a boy in Gutu, Zimbabwe. Tetena, take me back to your childhood in Zimbabwe. You were raised as a boy for about 10 years. What are your first memories in terms of how you connected who you are to other people?
I remember just failing miserably to connect to other boys, and I tried so many times. And I couldn't understand or contemplate why I was being raised as a boy, because I knew from very early on that I was not a boy.
As you grew up in Zimbabwe, did you hear about LGBTQ people? Was that something that was even on your mind?
Not at all, because in Zimbabwe, LGBTQI plus lives are criminalized, so it's taboo to even talk about it.
Did your parents ask you to keep your condition a secret?
Oh, for sure. And I do understand why they say that, because there was a belief actually one time that we are the ones that stops the rain from coming, and so we are bad luck. We're a bad omen to a community. So all of those things surrounding that condition made them feel like they couldn't allow me to be out with it because they knew it was going to be horrible for me.
So after years of expressing that you really felt like a girl, not a boy, even though you're being raised a boy, you eventually get your period at age 14. And so you have something very concrete to say, you know, I think I'm a girl.
I have to say, for me, although I knew I wanted a concrete proof to say, okay, this is just not in my head, because people would react to me as if I was crazy. So when I had a period, for me, it was like an aha moment. And, you know, Oprah Winfrey always talks about an aha moment. And I think that was my aha moment to get a period, because it was like, you see what I've been telling you? You know, I can get a period.
And how did your parents react? What did they do?
My mother tells me she cried a lot, and she just felt like she had not listened to me when I was telling her. I think it was one of those times she had a turning point. It was quite a positive thing for it to happen to my family, because they were also at one point in doubt of what I was telling them and what I was going through.
Did you then start to dress as a woman and identify as a woman?
I had always dressed as a woman. I always tried to dress in the middle. I always knew that if I dressed in the middle, then I wouldn't have the community saying, why is that boy dressing as a girl? But then after the period thing, I was like, I am not dressing as a boy anymore, because I cannot hide this anymore.
There's a particular point where you're 16 years old and your mother saw you in public and she saw that you were wearing a bra. What was her reaction?
She flipped. Oh, boy, that was, I'll never forget that. Because she used to tell me to wear things that don't show that my breasts were growing. And then one day I was like, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm proud of my breasts and I want to show them off. And my mother, her face flashed. I mean, she's a black woman, but I'll tell you, she turned red. she was just so angry and said, why do you have to do that? Why do you have to embarrass yourself? And why do you have to embarrass me? And it was such a painful moment for me.
Did you have anyone you could confide in or talk to during those times?
I did not have anybody, because I couldn't trust anyone. So I didn't have a safe place to go. And I stopped even writing in diaries because I was so scared of someone stealing that diary and reading all the stuff. So I didn't really confide in anyone.
But now a few years later, you leave Zimbabwe and move to South Africa. Was that a better place for you to be? And could you then represent yourself as a woman?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I had gone to South Africa to try and get a job and also to find doctors that could explain to me more about my intersex situation. And when I moved to South Africa, that's when I met a lot of people in the LGBTQ community, people who were different and who had struggled in being themselves. And I related to that struggle, of course.
Was that also the first time you ever heard the term intersex?
Yes, that was the first time.
Now, you lived in South Africa for 4 years, and then you returned to Zimbabwe. How did that go?
It was a conscious decision that I made because I wanted change for my own people, because I thought, okay, in South Africa, I'm working with all these communities, but no one is doing that back at home. And my father always taught me that charity begins at home.
Eventually, you decided to move to the United States. Why?
I had been physically abused for running this organization, and men trying to do corrective rape with me and saying, oh, you consider yourself a woman, why don't I have sex with you to prove that you're a woman, and things like that. And I had been attacked before. But the last straw was people actually said they wanted to burn down our house whilst we were inside. And then I thought, okay, I mean, it's one thing me dying over this, but I don't want my parents to get into trouble because of me.
So your parents were getting death threats over your involvement and activism around being intersex.
Mm-hmm.
In 2016, when you had decided to come to the U.S., your dad had just received his pension, and instead of using it for retirement, he gave the money to you to use for a plane ticket to fly to the U.S. What did that mean to you?
I think that is the reason why I wake up in the morning every day. He would give anything for my happiness. And that makes me feel very strong. And I want him to see that I appreciate it, and I see him, and I see that kind of love.
What was it like to move to the U.S.?
I moved to America in 2016 in August. I landed in L.A., and I had $60 in my purse when I landed in L.A. And then I got out, bought a SIM card for my phone, and I Googled where the L.A. LGBT Center was. And then I took a taxi and went to L.A. LGBT Center. And I said, hi, my name is Tatiana. I'm an activist, and I'm want to seek asylum. And I don't have a place to live, and I don't have food. And please help me. I have no money.
And did you get help?
I did not. I actually slept outside the LA LGBT Center for two nights, and we tried to reach out to shelters that were around that center, and they were all full. So I slept outside and wrote on Facebook asking for help, and then a stranger saw my post and said, your best bet would be New York, so what I can do for you is buy you a ticket so that you fly to New York and try and find some help.
Did you get asylum here in the U.S.?
It is still pending, but I was able to apply for it and file.
But you found help and assistance in New York once you got there?
Yes, I did.
Have you been able to visit Zimbabwe since you left?
I have not.
And when's the last time you saw your parents?
2016 in August, the day that they took me to the airport.
How often do you talk to them?
I speak to my parents every day. Thank God for WhatsApp.
I want to play a clip from a documentary you were in. It's called She's Not a Boy. And these are people at the New York Pride Parade, and they were asked if they knew what the I means in LGBTQI.
I only know what LGBTQ is. I don't know the I.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I do know that it means intersex, but I've never, like, researched too much about it.
Like, we know, like, the basics of it.
The LGBTQ.
We don't know, like the whole variety of that.
Did that lack of understanding and knowledge, did that surprise you?
It surprised me totally. Back when I was in Zimbabwe, America for me was, oh, you know, Obama is president and there are transgender people that are being shown on TV shows and Caitlyn Jenner is being celebrated and things like that. And I thought, this is a country that I can go to and it's going to be very open-minded and welcoming to me being intersex. And they are definitely going to want to know more. And I'm sure there are plenty of intersex people there that are being celebrated. And when I moved here, I literally had a rude awakening because intersex was still just as silent as back in Africa.
You know, you've been in the U.S. For a while now, and despite not being able to be with your family and all the hardships you've been through here, are there parts of your life here in the U.S. that make you glad you fled Zimbabwe?
The freedom of speech. The fact that I can be on a radio show freely like this and walking outside and not caring who's going to hear it and if I'm going to be into trouble, because those are the things that you have to deal with when you're back in Zimbabwe. If you go on a public platform, you know you're going to be attacked afterwards. So I'm very glad that I came to this country, because the freedom of speech is really, really the best gift that Americans have.
Tatiana Inwaru is an intersex woman who fled her home country of Zimbabwe to seek asylum in America. Thanks a lot, Tatiana.
Thank you so much for having me.
Romanians dress as bears. Mexicans and Brazilians wear colorful underwear. And Ecuadorians run down the street with empty suitcases. Those are some of the ways different countries ring in the new year. In Japan, it sounds like this. Amateur Japanese singers train for months perfecting their voices and their German. This isn't just any rehearsal of Ludwig van Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. It's become a Japanese end-of-year tradition. A choir of more than 10,000 belted out, which includes the Ode to Joy movement. Japanese musicians first played Ode to Joy in 1925. But why choose a notoriously difficult work for amateurs to sing and memorize in German? For the challenge. The choir director, Yutaka Tomozawa, called the feeling of accomplishment sublime. Just a few more hours left in 2019, but billions of people around the world have already rung in the new year. As always, the first major city to usher things in was Sydney, Australia. Around a million spectators flocked to the Sydney Harbour and nearby districts as more than 100,000 fireworks exploded over the city's iconic Harbour Bridge and Opera House. An array of bright colors filled the night sky. Meanwhile, less than 100 miles away, raging bushfires painted the sky in apocalyptic orange. It's put a big damper on celebrations tonight. Flames and smoke are covering large parts of Victoria and New South Wales. Sydney is the capital there. Thousands of people along the country's eastern seaboard are fleeing from the flames and seeking refuge on beaches. With all of this, more than 250,000 people signed a petition calling for Sydney's New Year's Eve fireworks to be canceled and for the money to be spent on fighting the wildfires instead. Linda McCormick started the petition.
It's not ideal to send more smoke up into the air. I am really, really getting angry.
But Sydney's Lord Mayor, Clover Moore, decided the show must go on.
We began preparations and planning for New Year's Eve celebrations 15 months ago, and most of the budget, which largely goes to crowd safety and cleaning measures, has already been allocated.
Moore also said she has deep sympathies for those who had signed the petition, but cancelling the fireworks would be of little use to those who'd lost so much in the fires. She said the celebration was a way of bringing the community together. Some smaller Australian cities did listen to public sentiments and cancelled their fireworks shows. And many, like McCormick, say fireworks tonight in Sydney are an insult and can traumatize some affected by the bushfires.
It's a sign of respect not to blow smoke up in the air when the country's on fire.
The fires in Australia have killed at least 12 people since October. Two more bodies were recovered today, and several people remain missing. Some 10 million acres have been destroyed across Australia. That's an area larger than Maryland. The petition to stop Sydney's fireworks show was a small protest in a year of big displays of public activism. Before we say goodbye to 2019 and the 2010s, the world's Rupa Shenoy has this look back on a decade of global protests.
In 2010,
it's the first day of a new decade, and in the UK, hundreds of thousands of party
there was a sense of hope.
Mayor Boris Johnson said the display showed the most exciting city on earth was looking forward to the future with optimism and energy.
But the world was also coming off the 2008 global economic collapse, and Zachariah Mompilly says there was an undercurrent of resentment. He's an international studies professor at the City University of New York.
There's a sense that there has been a tremendous increase in inequality around the world.
A few elites seem to hold all the power.
There is increasingly a lack of faith in government, that national governments in particular are no longer able to craft solutions to some of the most existential problems that we face as a species.
The frustration boils over. It starts with one person in Tunisia. Fruit vendor Mohamed Bouazizi snaps when officials try to confiscate his cart. He sets himself on fire.
His cousin used his mobile phone to start filming the protests which developed.
It becomes the Arab Spring.
Now across the square, it looks like there's a melee happening. The crowd, there's sticks flying, there's things flying in the air.
Demonstrators force the Tunisian and Egyptian presidents from power. Then the Occupy movement sweeps the globe.
We are!
After that, there were too many to list. Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter.
Me Too. Civil uprising in Syria. Sudan, Chile. Global protests for action on climate change.
Globally speaking, we live in the most contentious time in recorded human history as civil resistance goes.
Erica Chenoweth at Harvard has studied every reported instance back to 1900.
This is a way that people try to get what they want when they don't feel like the normal political process is operating in ways that can accommodate their demands.
And it's had an impact.
If you look at a movement like Occupy, which many people called a failure, the truth is that the agenda that was set by Occupy, that is a focus on inequality, was taken up by basically everyone.
But governments have fought back. In Sudan, the military executed a brutal crackdown. In Kashmir,
nearly 4 million people have been confined to their homes in a total communications blackout.
India cut off the internet. Hardi Miraman is president of the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict.
We see an increasing number of movements at the same time that we see a documented decline in democracies around the world and an increase in authoritarianism.
Miraman says nonviolent civil resistance isn't as effective as it used to be.
The success rate of nonviolent movements is declining. Part of that could be because there are an increasing number of violent flanks alongside these movements.
Another part might be the changing role of the U.S.
We will seek friendship and goodwill with the nations of the world, but we do so with the understanding that it is the right of all nations to put their own interests first.
Historian and former provost of the University of Melbourne, Peter McPhee, says President Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord, the Iran nuclear deal, and the International Criminal Court have led other countries to believe they could act without facing international repercussions.
There is an assumption around the world that the great powers can act more or less as they want. And I think that's actually adding to a sense around the world that the democratic rules have been abandoned, and it's a question of what you can get away with.
Protesters are adapting. Dawn Brancati is at the Macmillan Center for International Studies at Yale University. One of her students is Nathan Law, one of the leaders of the movement in Hong Kong. She says civil resistors there have learned how to keep a movement cohesive and how to evade the police.
In terms of sheer numbers, there's 2 million people in a single day on the streets of Hong Kong. Hong Kong's entire population is 7 million people. It's phenomenal.
And Brancati says, like other protesters earlier in the decade, those in Hong Kong haven't been deterred by a government crackdown.
Even when authoritarian regimes crack down, the protesters keep going in the streets, which is why I admire their courage and guts. And so I expect there will be protests, and I expect there will be further repression, and I expect the protesters to be undaunted and to continue to go out in the streets to protest.
So this might just be the beginning. The 2020s may bring more unrest. Hopefully, though, they'll also eventually bring change and peaceful solutions to the problems we face. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. And from everyone here at The World, we wish you a safe and wonderful new year.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.